This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Esther. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Esther, chapter 5, with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Well, let's get our Bibles out. We're in the book of Esther, and we are going to finish up tonight, not just the book of Esther, but we're going to finish up the historical books of the Old Testament tonight. This is the last of the historical books. After we study through Matthew in the coming year, then we'll jump right back to the book of Job, and we'll begin the section of Scripture known as the poetical books of the Hebrew Scriptures. So, a lot to look forward to there. You know, the book of Esther is a story full of daring and intrigue. It's what we might call a cliffhanger. It's one of my favorite Bible books. But the book of Esther is not without its opponents. Did you know that Martin Luther wrote of this book, "I'm so great an enemy to the book of Esther that I wish it had not come to us at all, for it has too many heathen perversions." It is true that Esther and her cousin Mordecai were not pristine examples of Jewish orthodoxy. They broke dietary laws. They violated the Sabbath laws. Esther even married a pagan, idol-worshipping king. The two of them, Esther and Mordecai, had very little interest in returning to their Jewish homeland and rebuilding their temple and reestablishing their nation. And worse, in the book of Esther, in these 167 verses, the name Ahasuerus, the corrupt Gentile king, appears 190 times, while God's name, Jehovah, is never mentioned, not even once. But the rejection of this book is due to the misunderstanding of its message. Esther and Mordecai represent the attitude of the diaspora Jews throughout the centuries, and in modern times, the state of Israel. As were Esther and Mordecai in Persia, Jews today are fiercely loyal to their Jewishness. Modern Israelis are prepared to die defending their culture and their heritage and their survival as a people. But they're far more patriotic than they are pious. In Israel today, religious Jews are a minority. Modern Israelis have embraced Western culture by and large. They're indifferent to the laws of Moses. Drive down the freeway in Tel Aviv, and you'll see the billboards of scantily clad models selling commercial products. It's Western secularism at its best. In fact, Israeli leaders will talk about the indomitable human spirit, and yet seldom do they give God the credit for their country's remarkable resurgence and its military successes. But here's the point of the book. Despite the Jews' unfaithfulness to God, God has remained faithful to the Jews. It's another example of God's amazing grace. God's providence is His overarching supervision in the affairs of man, and His providence has protected and guided the Jews throughout their history. Psalm 121 puts it, "He who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep." And indeed he hasn't. One author sums up the message of Esther as follows: the absence of the name of God does not mean the absence of the hand of God. Remember that. Well, before we dive into chapter 5, let's recap the first four chapters. Esther was a Jewish orphan. She was raised by her older cousin Mordecai. Esther is a beauty queen who really does become a queen. She's taken into the king's harem in an ancient version of The Bachelor. Each girl gets a night with the king, and the babe he likes best is the one who's crowned. Esther is interviewed, and she's the one who gets chosen. Meanwhile, Mordecai, he has a run-in with a Jew hater named Haman. Haman was the king's administrator. He was an egomaniac, and he expected everyone to bow to him as his entourage passed through the city gates. When Mordecai refuses to bow, Haman puts out a contract, not only to kill Mordecai, but to kill all the Jews within a year. Mordecai believes that God has placed Esther in the king's palace, quote, for such a time as this. It's her duty in his mind to go before the king on behalf of the Jews. Esther knows anyone who approaches King Ahasuerus uninvited takes a big risk, losing their head. But after mulling it over, after thinking it through, she becomes willing to take the risk. You remember her immortal words, if I perish, I perish. But chapter 5 begins. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. She's trembling. You know she is. Her life is on the line. If the sight of his queen doesn't please King Ahasuerus, Esther will be executed on the spot. The golden scepter pointed her way is her only salvation. You know, it's been said, a rash person acts without fear. A brave person acts in spite of it. We all get afraid. But Esther allowed her faith to rise above her fears. You've heard this old saying, when your knees knock, kneel on them. Apparently, that's what Esther had done. She refused to buckle under to her fears. She gets on her knees, she trusts the Lord, and then she goes in to obey. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, what do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom. Obviously, God had softened the king's heart for Esther's arrival. Now the king is in a generous mood. So Esther answered, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Now Esther is acting shrewdly. Remember what we talked about last week. Ahasuerus was renowned as quite a boozer. He loved to drink. He was probably an alcoholic. And in verse 6 here, Esther invites him to a banquet. But literally, it's a banquet of wine. Queen Esther invites the king and Haman to her place for a few drinks. She thinks she stands a better chance of tipping the king her way if she can get him a little tipsy. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom. Wow, talk about a blank check. It shall be done. Here for a second time, she's being asked to make her request. Again, though, she refuses. And it's interesting. You wonder why. Perhaps she's building up enough nerve. Maybe she's waiting for the perfect timing. Perhaps she's doing both. Then Esther answered and said, my petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. She invites Ahasuerus and Haman to another banquet the next day. So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate and that he did not stand or tremble before him, in other words, he refused to be intimidated, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Haman's going home. He's feeling fine. If it were not for that Jew, that stubborn Jew, Mordecai, who refuses to bow like everyone else. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Haman calls together his friends and his neighbors. His wife is there. He's hosting this impromptu dinner party, and he toasts himself in all of his successes. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. You could tell he's feeling great. I've even been invited to a private audience with the queen. And yet there's one burr in Haman's happy saddle. The fly in this guy's coffee is a guy named Mordecai. Verse 13 reveals Haman's frustration. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Haman should have been happy, but he seethes over the Jew who defies his authority. Mordecai has a thorn in his side, and it is a type of the whole Jewish race. In his book, Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler sounded like Haman when he wrote these words. Wherever I went, I began to see Jews. Gradually, I began to hate them. Hitler, like many others before and since, were jealous of the Jews. You see, throughout history, wherever the Jewish people have settled, God in His providence has blessed the Jews. He's blessed them with a Midas touch. They've been successful everywhere they've settled. From the Middle Ages onward, Jews excelled at banking and finance. A disproportionate number of Jews became physicians and merchants. Gentile jealousy became one of the leading factors of Jewish persecution. Mark Twain, himself a Jew, once wrote these words, "I'm convinced the crucifixion has not much to do with the world's attitude toward the Jew. The reasons for it are much older than that. The Jew is a money getter, and in getting his money, he is a very serious obstacle to less capable neighbors who are in the same quest. The cost to him has been heavy. His successes has made the whole human race his enemy." Indeed. And this is the problem in the Middle East today. For hundreds of years, the Palestinians cared nothing about the land that we today call Israel. It was a desert. It was a wasteland. Then, around the turn of the last century, Zionist Jews began to return to the land. And what did they do? They drained the swamps, and they planted trees, and they developed farms, and they irrigated valleys, and they turned what was once a desert into a garden. Now, suddenly, the Palestinians want their land back. For centuries, they cared nothing about it until the Jews returned and turned it into an oasis. Once again, the Jews have fallen victim to the jealousy of their neighbors. Mordecai was a thorn in a Gentile side, just as the Jews have been for centuries. Verse 14. Then his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits tall, about 75 feet high. And in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet." Sadly, Zeresh's suggestion has been an all too common response to Gentile jealousy of the Jews. Just kill them. That's what Hitler said. Take the Jews to the gallows. Sadly, the thing pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made, and apparently the construction took place immediately. The gallows went up overnight. If Haman can swing it with the king the next morning, Mordecai will be swinging before nightfall. In chapter 6, the scene shifts to the king's bedroom, verse 1. That night, the king could not sleep. Evidently, the guy at Little Caesar's put anchovies on his pizza. Because he couldn't sleep. And the king needed some shut-eye. He had a busy day in front of him. And so what do you do when you can't sleep? You bring out the royal records. Surely a few pages of governmental regulations will put anybody to sleep. And so we're told, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. But guess what page gets read. Here we go again. God's providence is at work. Verse 2 tells us, and it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. You remember at the end of chapter 2 when Mordecai uncovered this plot to assassinate the king. He snitched to Esther. Esther told the king, and it saved Ahasuerus' life. Mordecai's bravery and his loyalty to the king had been recorded, but had gone unrewarded. And I'm sure Mordecai felt cheated at the time. Maybe he even felt betrayed by the king. Perhaps he felt betrayed by God. Hey, I do this good deed and nothing happens. But there was a reason. And guys, there is always a reason. God has his purposes. Just because you feel cheated, just because you go unrewarded, doesn't mean that God has forgotten or that God has neglected. Perhaps God has a reason hidden from view that's going to come back to play in the near future. Well, God's purpose is about to be revealed in Mordecai's life. Then the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Amazing. What are the odds? Out of thousands of pages in the royal register, the one that's chosen to put the king asleep happens to mention Mordecai's kind deed. What are the odds of that? This was obviously no accident. Again, God's providence was on display. Well, the king needs a courier to deliver Mordecai's reward. And so he asks, "Is there anyone in the building?" And guess who shows up early for work that morning? So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. You know, as the rabbis say, coincidence is not a kosher word. There are no accidents with God. I wonder how many circumstances have occurred in our lives that were the hand of God, and yet we chalk them up to coincidence. Oh, well, that just happened. It's amazing how many interesting circumstances just so happen in this book of Esther. Hey, when it just so happens in our life, when circumstances come together in God's preordained plan, let's make sure that we give God credit where credit is due. Verse 5. The king's servants said to him, "Well, Haman is here, and he's standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" Haughty Haman assumes the king's talking about him. And so he lays it on thick, man. He goes lavish. And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Oh my, here's Haman's suggestion to the king. "Deck this man out in your own royal threads. Put him on a white stallion. Throw a parade in his honor. Sing his praises through the street." All the time thinking that this man is him. Then the king said to Haman, "You know, I like your idea. Hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." New robe, $800. Horse, $2,000. Parade, $5,000. Look on Haman's face, priceless. Haman turns white as a sheet, man. His jaw must have dropped 3 feet. Verse 11. So Haman took the robe and the horse. I mean, he had no choice. This was now the king's command. And he arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." And Haman had to have died every step of the way. And Mordecai's reaction to all of this had to have been just as funny. I mean, how do you react when your mortal enemy becomes the leader of the parade in your honor? I mean, wow. Well, afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." Perhaps they were aware of God's blessing on the Jews. And they're thinking, wait a minute, you've picked a fight with one of God's kids. And in doing so, you've picked a fight with God. You're not going to stand, Haman, you're going to fall. Well, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. All of a sudden, the limousine arrives. It's going to take Haman to the banquet with Queen Esther. He gets in the limo, and he'll never return home. You think this is as low as he can go. You think Haman has hit bottom. You figure Haman has just gotten a 23-month sentence for dogfighting. But believe it or not, it's going to get worse. His coach is about to quit. Chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done." And finally, Esther spills the beans, and she gets to her request. Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." Verse 5. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, and she had to have pointed to her other dinner guest, "The adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman." And so Haman was terrified before the king and queen. I have no doubt that verse is inspired. Haman wants to go home and crawl back into bed and try getting up on the other side this time. I mean, this is a bad day he's having. What happens next is wild. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. Now, Ahasuerus is furious. His trusted officer has plotted to kill his wife and all of his in-laws. And recall, when Ahasuerus gets mad, he makes rash decisions.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy spoke to us from the book of Esther today. Esther's life did not go exactly as planned. She was the definition of a fish out of water for so many years until she aligned with God's purpose for her life. From that day forward, she led a purpose-driven and meaningful testimony for God. Her example of following God's will for her life led others to become living witnesses and had a tremendous impact on faith as we know it today. You may not be completely sure of God's will for your life, there will be times you feel led clearly, and then all of a sudden you realize the target has moved. Have you aligned with God's purpose for your life? If you'd like to hear more messages like this one, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. If you're in the Atlanta area, why not come visit us? We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. There's more information and directions at sandyadams.org. Well, that's about all we have time for today, but we look forward to our time together again very soon. There's so much more to share with you as Pastor Sandy teaches again from the Word of God on the next edition of Sandy Adams Radio.